shockwaves from George Floyd's death from Minneapolis across the world. People everywhere are marching for Floyd and demanding justice in their own countries.
There were almost 6,000 people that the Brazilian police kill every year. Three quarters, 75%, are Afro-Brazilians, black people.
Also today, an American Navy veteran released from prison in Iran. Michael White's mom waited 2 years for this.
She's probably the happiest woman in America today.
And in Italy, the lockdown gave Milan new streets. Cars disappeared and pedestrians ruled the roads.
The only time when I felt pleasure going through, it was during the quarantine, when the road was deserted and you could walk with your eyes closed with the red traffic lights.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis policeman has forced a reckoning in the United States like never before. Many Americans who previously had the privilege of being able to ignore police violence toward African Americans are now starting to understand they can't anymore. A similar realization is starting to dawn on Brazilians after the police killing of a 14-year-old boy named João Pedro Matos Pinto. Pinto was killed during a botched police raid in Rio last month. People across Brazil have taken to the streets to protest. Mauricio Santoro teaches politics at the State University of Rio de Janeiro. He joins us from Rio. So, Mauricio, what happened to João Pedro Matos Pinto?
The precise details of the death of João Pedro are still being debated because there are different versions from the police officers that took part on the raid. But what we know for sure is that there was a police raid in his neighborhood, a very violent one, and the police entered his home and fired dozens of shots because they were trying to go after some people that had committed crimes and so on. But even so, they invaded the home of an innocent family and they killed a very young boy. And this is something that sadly happens all the time in Brazil in poor neighborhoods. Brazilians would never tolerate that in a middle-class neighborhood, in a white middle-class family. But many people more or less accept the police behavior when it happens in a favela, when it happens in a slum. So what's happening now in Brazil is that many people are saying enough is enough.
So 14-year-old Pinto was black, and we know police violence against Afro-Brazilians has long been a problem in Brazil. But why has this killing, the killing of João Pedro Matos Pinto, why has it led to this powerful response, do you think?
Yes, what happened to João Pedro was not an exception, was not an isolated case, but it happened in a moment where people are very angry. And I think that everything that Brazilian people need right now, especially in Rio, was just this one case of injustice, this one case of the brutality of the state to explode. I mean, we are in the middle of a pandemic. The official numbers are that more than 35,000 Brazilians have died. But at the same time, the police is still going out in violent raids in favelas, in other poor communities. And it's still killing a lot, even with the quarantine, even with the lockdown.
Of course, this problem goes back much further than the last few weeks. So in separate reports, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have described local police in Rio as the most violent in the world. We've seen other critics describe the policies of Rio police as a state-sponsored genocide. So what is the depth of this problem?
Sure. Let me give some numbers to make a comparison with the United States. In the last years, the American police has been killing around 1,100 people each year. In Brazil, last year, it was almost 6,000. If we look just to the police of Rio de Janeiro, the police of Rio killed more people than the police of all the United States.
And that is stunning. And of those police killings, what percentage are represented by Afro-Brazilians?
Well, of this almost 6,000 people that the Brazilian police kill every year, three quarters, 75%, are Afro-Brazilians, black people.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. It's a very high number.
And the reaction from the people of Rio, the Cariocas, has concern spread beyond the Afro-Brazilian community into kind of like the wider citizens of the city.
Oh, absolutely. This is something that is spreading beyond favelas, spreading beyond poor neighborhoods and across race lines. And I think that many people in Brazil are looking to the United States right now and feeling touched and inspired by what is happening on the American cities, especially the solidarity between white and black people. This is something that we should learn from the Americans and using Brazil as well. So, for example, we have been watching the news in the last days in Brazil, and if you go to television, you're going to see black journalists and black intellectuals commenting about police violence. This is a first in Brazil. Mm. It's the first time that we are seeing something like that happening. So it's a really important change. And it's also important to notice that in Brazil, Afro-Brazilians, black Brazilians, they are the majority of the population. So in that point, it's very different from the United States, where African-Americans are more or less 12% of the population. In Brazil, we're talking about 55%, more or less.
Brazil has a Black Lives Matter movement. Has it had an impact on police violence?
There is something like the Black Lives Matter happening in Brazil right now, but it's still something very fragmented, more at the local level of the communities, of the favelas. It's not really a national movement, at least until now. And in this sense, what's happening in the United States is a very strong source of inspiration to many Brazilians.
Yeah, talk about that more. I mean, what are the lines of communication, and how are people kind of getting these messages?
Well, the Brazilian media is paying lots of attention to what's happening in the United States. So every day and every night, we have many images and photos and news stories from America. And also, I think that many Brazilians identify a lot with the United States, much more than other countries. And when we are watching these big demonstrations in the United States, I think that for many Brazilians, the big question is, well, why something similar is not happening in Brazil right now? Because we are facing the same problems.
Mm. Mauricio, what's been the position of President Jair Bolsonaro to this whole problem of police violence in Brazil?
Bolsonaro is reacting in a very similar way to Trump. And Bolsonaro is trying to stigmatize the demonstrations as something violent. He's calling the people on the street terrorists and extremists. And there is this fear that he will try to do something illegal, perhaps using the army to repress the demonstrations and something like that. And Bolsonaro is very influent in the police in Brazil. He has many supporters among police officers. And there is a political struggle going on between the president and the state governors who control the police in Brazil for the influence among police officers, who they're going to obey. So this is going to be a major problem in Brazil in the next weeks.
You've given us a lot to think about. Mauricio Santoro, a specialist on Brazilian politics at the State University of Rio de Janeiro. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco. It was a pleasure.
These protests around the world are highlighting the way racism impacts every aspect of society. That includes health. Today in Washington, a congressional committee met to examine the racial health inequalities around COVID-19. Here's Chairman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina.
These protests are about more than the treatment of African Americans at the hands of police. They're also about the systemic racial inequities that have festered in our society for years and are now magnified by the coronavirus that we're here to talk about.
This is not just a problem in the United States. In the UK, a report released this week found that people from ethnic minorities are at a higher risk of dying from coronavirus. But what the report did not do is make recommendations for how the government can address these disparities. Dr. Hina Shahid is the chair of the Muslim Doctors Association in the UK. She joins us from London.
The findings of the report are pretty much what we already knew. The report confirmed that age is a big factor, along with living in deprived areas, having underlying conditions, being from an ethnic minority, being in various occupations. But we already knew this, so it didn't really add anything extra to what we knew already.
What the report does not do is put forward recommendations for how to address these disparities. Was that something you were expecting to see? And is this a really missed opportunity?
Yes. I mean, this is a common sentiment, you know, of disappointment. Actually, disappointment is an understatement with what, you know, various BAME organizations are saying. Racial discrimination plays a huge role in accounting for the disparities that we see in health outcomes among BAME groups. And we were really hoping to get some information on what some of those discriminatory factors look like. You know, we had hoped initially that it would answer some of those questions around the whys and the hows. But what it does is just kind of give a summary of the what, which was already known.
So BAME, just for our American listeners, that's a British acronym for Black, Asian, and Minority Ethnic, BAME. Doctor, what do you think the British government should be doing to protect BAME Britons from coronavirus?
There's a lot that needs to be done. And, you know, the first thing starts with having the right data so that we can understand what is going on. The data that was published has a very narrow scope. So we have, you know, it hasn't been disaggregated by ethnic minorities. We don't know the range of clinical risk factors. We don't have a good idea of some of the wider social and economic factors. And importantly, there's no research that's been done on exploring specifically the impact of discrimination and those experiences of discrimination and how they are affecting health inequalities. But we need to acknowledge that racism and discrimination plays a huge part.
Your organization, Doctor, the Muslim Doctors Association, actually put forward recommendations that were not published in the report. Why do you think that is?
We've seen that Muslim communities have been particularly affected by COVID-19 in the UK. And that's because of the intersection of discrimination and disadvantage that Muslim majority ethnic groups face. One of the recommendations we put forward was that we need data on faith or religion to be published. And also legally in the UK, this is a protected characteristic. And if you're going to be doing any research on inequalities, you need to really reach out to those vulnerable groups. It wasn't covered in this particular review. One of the reasons is because the data quality currently is quite poor. And that is true because we've looked at the data ourselves.
Dr. Shahid, as a doctor, do you feel like you've gotten enough guidance and protection from the government when you go in to see patients every day?
This has been a really big issue for frontline workers. I don't know whether you're aware of the statistics that we have, in the UK, but for doctors, for example, over 90% of doctors who've died have been from an ethnic minority background, and that is huge. People have actually reported that they felt bullied at work, that they have felt pressurized to work in unsafe conditions, that they've not had access to adequate protective equipment. Again, that points to long-standing discrimination, which may be accounting for the disproportionate impact and deaths that we've seen amongst ethnic minority frontline workers. And this is very serious. And yes, it's created a lot of anxiety around frontline workers who are scared to go into work. There have been some risk reduction frameworks that the National Health Service has produced to try and reduce that risk. But actually, you know, it's not really been taken up properly. A lot of colleagues have not really had any risk assessment at work. So, you know, there's policy formulation, there's policy implementation. We haven't really seen the implementation at all, to be honest.
Dr. Hina Shahid is the chair of the Muslim Doctors Association in the UK. She's been speaking with us from London. Dr. Shahid, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Coming up on The World, the fight against COVID-19 in the UK includes a telephone contact tracing scheme, but so far most of the tracers have not called anyone yet. You're with The World.
The World supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As lockdowns slowly lift, cars are coming back on the roads. So are congestion and traffic. But in some places across the globe, residents want to hold on to some of the car-free culture that flourished while cities were at their quietest. That's what we're looking at this week in The World's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect
the next few thousand years.
Lots of cities are starting to think about how to open up their streets to more bicycles and pedestrians. Milan in northern Italy is one of them. It's going further than most cities in rethinking and reshaping its streets post-pandemic, planning more than 22 miles of new walking and biking paths. Pier Francesco Maran is deputy mayor of urban planning for Milan.
The idea is to accelerate some project the city has got even before. So we decided especially to create new bike lanes over the subway lines. So like to have the same itinerary to do it by bike instead of by subway as before.
So you were already working on plans similar to what you started here. This seems the pandemic seems to have accelerated it. Why did you think you needed those plans?
It's 10 years we are working to reduce pollution, to reduce congestion, to move in a better way. We were weak on bike lanes. Before, the idea is that you move by public transport and go to pedestrian areas. So now we are trying to increase even bike lanes with this plan.
So every decision has a trade-off, especially with city planning. When you make a bike lane, then cars can't go there anymore. So what do you say to people who believe that these changes will bring more congestion and traffic to the drivers of Milan? And they'll also say you're making life harder for people with cars.
Well, it's true. Streets sometimes it looks like a fight because there are people that prefer to walk and bike that ask for more, and people that use car that say it was better before. We have to listen to everybody, even the people that complains. But our idea is that cities are not just made for cars. We have to find space for everybody.
How much do you think the pandemic has changed minds about how to use the streets of Milan?
My opinion is that you push on your previous opinion. So people that think that climate change is a problem, that they want a different city, ask for more than before. And people that prefer to use car, they push more on that because they feel safer on car. Instead of talking each other, people go more than before on their specific idea.
You've posted videos of yourself cycling on a new bike lane in Milan, Pier Francesco. How does it feel to physically be in that new space that was just an idea on paper a couple of months ago?
To be true, it's incredible, unbelievable, the fact that it's happening day by day, block after block. And even for people like me, we are making politics because we want also to change our city. The idea that after pandemic, we try to have a better city, it's something that is fantastic. And to ride in something you create, it's so emotionally.
Pier Francesco Maran is deputy mayor of urban planning for Milan. Thank you very much for speaking with us and good luck.
Thank you.
So what does it actually feel like on the city's first reimagined street? Let me take you to Milan's busy Corso Buenos Aires. Before the pandemic, cars swerved down four lanes of traffic. People crowded sidewalks, heading to cafes, piazzas, and stores in an area that's home to the highest concentration of clothing shops in Europe. Milan resident Antonio Rovaldi says he didn't used to be a fan.
The only time when I felt pleasure going through, it was during the quarantine, when the road was deserted and you could walk with your eyes closed with the red traffic lights.
Now people are starting to come back to the street, but a transformed version of its old self. Two new bike lanes take the place of one lane of traffic, and pedestrians give each other more space than they used to. As the city's lockdown starts to lift, we hear from four residents about how they're using the new space.
Hello, I am Sofia, a 19-year-old girl from Milan.
My name is Fabio, 27, and I live in Milan.
Pinar Pinsuti, I'm a full-time cycling brainwasher.
My name is Antonio Rovaldi, I'm a visual artist.
I'm in front of Porta Venezia, where the coast of Buenos Aires starts. It's 7 a.m. It's a wonderful day.
Corso Buenos Aires didn't used to be like this. I would come here to do some shopping and I wouldn't be able to move due to the big crowd.
Cycling here was never a pleasure. Parked cars on both sides and the traffic meant getting doored or getting hit.
There would be a lot of noise, people shouting and talking. I'd be pushed, and I'd also be afraid of pocket picking, holding onto my purse, where now everybody walks very distant from one another, so I think none of that could happen.
The city of Milan started to build the cycle lanes at the end of April.
Pretty new bicycle path, which is going all along the street. This is a revolution.
The street that I once avoided to visit became my favorite destination to observe the transformation.
I think the transformation, the changing of course, Buenos Aires mirrors a major changing in our society. The fact that the government decided to create this new bike path shows how they are starting to care more about the climate change issue. But I think it will be just a drop in the ocean.
There is a very long queue of traffic.
Everybody tends not to use buses, the metro or trams, since they are closed spaces.
I think this is longer than it used to be before quarantine.
So the environment will be greatly affected by this.
Many people are using their private cars in the city center. Having strategic bicycle paths can be a way to educate people to use them and to reflect on new ways of moving.
That story was produced by Anna Kussmer and Ian Koss. Last week, we asked you if your driving habits changed during lockdown. You told us that you're biking, walking, and scootering more, and driving less. Linda Seabright, who listens on KQED in the Bay Area, says her driving is way down.
There have been a lot more people walking. Really, in my neighborhood, I've seen people that I've never seen before, and that's wonderful. And I hope that keeps up.
We like making sure you're part of our conversation about climate change solutions, and we welcome your questions. Email us what's on your mind to climate@theworld.org. And for more stories about climate change solutions, visit us on the web at theworld.org/bigfix. June 4th, it's widely remembered as the day the Chinese government cracked down on protesters in Tiananmen Square. Today, China is cracking down on Hong Kong. But Beijing says it's not just us. Take a look at the U.S.
This kind of riots. I mean, why, if U.S. is not allowing this, why they should ask China to tolerate?
That story still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. There is some good news to report today. American Navy veteran Michael White, who is being held in Iran, is heading home. White was arrested in 2018 while on a visit to the country. President Trump commented on the release today. He said in a tweet that he will never stop working to secure the release of all Americans held overseas. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
According to his family, Michael White went to Iran to visit a woman he had met online. But during the trip, he was arrested by Iran's security forces and later sentenced to 10 years in prison. His charges include insulting Iran's supreme leader and violating the country's privacy laws. White and his family maintain he's innocent. They say the charges are bogus. Last year, White's mother, Joanne, reached out to former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson for help.
She was very upset. She's been talking about Michael's health for a long time, deteriorate him. She wants him home.
Before his trip to Iran, White had been treated for throat cancer. Richardson says White's health got worse when he was in prison. He contracted the coronavirus. Iran is one of the worst-hit countries in the Middle East. The Iranians released White on furlough, and since the U.S. doesn't have any official diplomatic relations with Iran, it was the Swiss that took care of him. They arranged for him to stay at a hotel, says Richardson.
I heard he was walking around, but still, he has the virus. His health has deteriorated, and so he needs immediate medical treatment.
Richardson spent the last year negotiating White's release.
I spoke personally to Foreign Minister Zarif in New York and then in Doha, Qatar, personally with Ambassador Ravanchi at the UN, telephone contact, constant. You know, there's always something in a negotiation that's difficult.
What's made these negotiations even more difficult, he says, is the worsening diplomatic relations between Iran and the U.S. The Trump administration has taken up what it calls a maximum pressure campaign against Iran in the past few years. It has increased sanctions and walked out of a nuclear deal that the Obama administration had signed with Iran. Still, Richardson says today is a happy day.
He's going to be home with his mother, and that's terrific, terrific for Michael White, who's been suffering as a prisoner.
This week, the U.S. released an Iranian scientist it had been holding. Cyrus Asghari was charged in 2016 with stealing trade secrets from a research project at the Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. Asghari, too, had reportedly contracted the coronavirus while in U.S. detention. The U.S. denies this was part of a prisoner swap. Still, there are at least three other Americans with dual U.S. and Iranian citizenship in custody in Iran. President Trump has vowed to secure the release of all of them. As for Michael White, he's expected to return to Arizona. I asked Richardson if he has any plans to meet him in person.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, it's very hard to travel these days with the COVID. I think we'll follow every safety precaution, but I'd really love to see him.
For now, he says a video call might have to do. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Heading back in time now for just a moment, the uprising in Beijing that began in the spring of 1989 was a movement for greater freedoms in communist China. It came to a violent end on June 4th when soldiers from the People's Liberation Army opened fire, killing hundreds, if not thousands. Every year on this date, the brutal crackdown is observed in Hong Kong. Today is different, though. As Beijing tightens its grip on Hong Kong, local officials are banning the commemoration because of the pandemic, they say. But many Hong Kongers are skeptical and worry the commemoration will be banned forever. The World's Patrick Nguyen joined me earlier.
Well, normally there would be this huge candlelight vigil, you know, as far as the eye can see, maybe tens of thousands of people. People who survived or witnessed the massacre might get on stage and speak. And it's just sort of this extraordinary thing because there's no other place on Chinese soil where you can honor the dead in Tiananmen. It's kind of exceptional, not without getting in trouble, of course. So now the commemoration is banned, but people are coming out. Last I checked, thousands of people were showing up anyway to commemorate Tiananmen. Police are out on the streets and people are defying the ban. Probably not as many people as would come normally because some people are scared of getting in trouble, but a lot are coming out. The backdrop to this is, of course, Hong Kong has had these protests for more than a year. And I actually spoke to one of the protesters, Frank Wong. He's the acting president of a student union at City University in Hong Kong. And he told me, look, you know, I wasn't even born in 1989. So for me, for us, Tiananmen is more like a symbol of how bad the Communist Party can be.
They view 4th of June as evidence of how untrustworthy the Chinese Communist Party is. And this adds to the main reason why we cannot rely on Chinese Communist Party to keep on the promise of one country, two system.
Yeah, so lack of faith in Beijing. What will Beijing make of this as they're tightening the screws on Hong Kong?
They'll be pleased that Hong Kong officials have banned it, even though it's ostensibly for reasons of COVID-19. But look, they just don't want anyone remembering this happened, period. Fortunately for them, the news cycle is in their favor because when U.S. politicians bring up Tiananmen, and many are doing so today, they can hit back with, well, wait, aren't you cracking down on protests against police violence in your country? Aren't you sending in the National Guard? Isn't Donald Trump calling for a military crackdown? So they are kind of hitting back at America using that angle today. As for what, you know, Beijing politicians or notable figures in Beijing will say about Tiananmen directly, well, they don't really talk about it, Marco. But we did reach a scholar named Wang Kuyao, who's president of a think tank in Beijing called the Center for China and Globalization. And he said, you know, when it comes to an uprising or quelling an uprising, the U.S. and China aren't as different as you'd like to think.
No country we're going to tolerate this kind of violence or this kind of riots. I mean, why, if U.S. is not allowing this, why they should ask China to tolerate? So, I mean, there's certainly double standards, I think.
And I would point out, Marco, he's referencing Hong Kong violence, but the point remains the same. Mm. We're doing crackdowns. You're no better than us.
How about Hong Kong's government, Patrick? Why are they going along with this ban?
Well, Hong Kong's government is very much beholden to Beijing, and that's getting more true every day. Beijing is really pushing Hong Kong officials to do two things. They want them to silence dissent among their own people, and they want Hong Kong officials to distance themselves from American politicians who might be cheering on the protest or commemorating Tiananmen Square, the massacre there. And so I spoke to a former Hong Kong politician, Christine Low. And what I got from her is any U.S. officials promoting dissidents in Hong Kong, promoting or commemorating the Tiananmen Square massacre, that is seen as a red line.
What China and also the Chinese people are worried about is that the U.S. is really calling for regime change in China. And regime change in China represents huge instability. I think China feels, why is it that at this stage, when I'm catching up, that I have to be presented as an evil system.
Hmm. Suffocating pressure from authority. Are Hong Kongers talking about other models of protest right now, Patrick, like what they're seeing in the U.S. right now?
There's been this really interesting symbiosis, at least online, where Hong Kong protesters have cheered on the protest against police violence triggered by the wrongful death of George Floyd. It's been interesting. So in Hong Kong, on the streets, they have developed some pretty sophisticated tactics for fighting back against riot cops. So like if a riot cop will throw a tear gas grenade, they'll put a traffic cone over it. And now you're starting to see that repeated on streets in America with American protesters putting this online and saying, hey, Hong Kong, look what we learned from you. So there's this interesting symbiosis between the two protest movements. And, no one's taken a poll, but overall, they seem to be kind of supporting each other and feeding off of each other.
The world's Patrick Nguyen on this Tiananmen Square uprising anniversary. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Governments around the globe are giving a lot of thought about how to transition from coronavirus life and back to normal life again. Countries like Singapore, South Korea, and Germany turn to contact tracing apps to plot their way forward, apps that will help researchers identify who you've been in contact with, establishing patterns of how the disease spreads. Britain, on the other hand, launched a tracking system using human contact tracers. How well is that working? From London, here's the world's Orla Barry.
Daryl Schneider is a trained dental nurse from Essex in southeast England, but her new job is a contact tracer with the government's new test and trace system. That means she calls up people who've tested positive for the coronavirus to ask about who they've been in contact with over the last 48 hours.
I need to find out 2 days prior whether they went to the gym, whether they went to work, whether they've had a dog sitter, a babysitter, anyone like that. And then they need to give me names and contact numbers or emails of them as well.
Once Schneider has those details, she cold calls those people. And one of the first things she tells them to do is self-isolate for 14 days. But that's not actually mandatory. It's more helpful advice.
If they want to help the world and make everything better and try and help other people, that's the best thing they can do. We can't force that on them. But as far as we're concerned, someone could say to us, yes, I'm going to isolate, thank you, and then they could go out. We don't know. We're not checking on them.
The UK government is banking on this new test and trace system as a way out of the lockdown. Schneider says she took the job because she wants to do something to help, but her optimism is not shared by all contact tracers. This is Becky. It's not her real name. She asked to remain anonymous and use this name instead.
I'm yet to make a single phone call or be assigned a case. I've had no contact from anyone. I've had no contact from supervisors. I've literally been on the system, refreshed the system and entertained myself during that watching Netflix.
Becky, who's a qualified nurse, says she believes the government rushed out the scheme before it was properly set up.
It's not ready yet. Hold fire. Not having a system up and running is obviously frustrating, but it's about people's lives.
There are numerous reports by other contact tracers on Facebook group pages with similar stories to Becky's. But the British Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, says the fact some workers have nothing to do is actually a positive sign.
The system is up and running, it's successful, and we've hired 25,000 people to work as contact tracers, and the level of incidence of disease has come down. So actually, we have more capacity than we need. This is a good thing.
If you think human contact tracers sounds, well, a little low-tech, you'd be right. Many other countries are now using apps which send an alert warning you if you've been in close proximity to someone who's tested positive for COVID-19. The UK government has an app in the works. It's been trialling it on the Isle of Wight, a small island off the south coast of England. Local resident Daniel James downloaded the app a month ago.
Well, I downloaded it in a spirit of optimism, and I really hoped it would help make a difference.
To be effective, at least 60% of the island's residents need to have it on their phones. So have James's neighbours shared his enthusiasm and downloaded the app?
Very few, I would say. I mean, most of them are retired people. I think the majority of our neighbours probably haven't, or if they have, then their phone is still switched off in the drawer.
The app needs Bluetooth to be switched on to function properly. It doesn't work on older phones, and it depends on people registering themselves as possibly having coronavirus symptoms. I asked James if he's received an alert saying someone nearby may have the virus.
Not as yet, no.
The app was due to be rolled out across England this week, but that plan has now been shelved. There are concerns about privacy too, and the new test and trace system is facing similar charges.
They collect information such as your full name, your date of birth, your sex, your NHS number, your postcode and house number, your telephone number and email address.
This is data lawyer Ravi Naik.
And that's obviously relatively basic information. But here's where the problems occur. Number one, that information will be stored for 20 years.
The health service says it needs to hold on to the information for 2 decades to understand how the coronavirus will affect people's lives in the future. But that's not Naik's main concern.
We know that private companies are already working with the NHS. There are companies like Google and Palantir who are working to try to use the data that's going into the NHS about COVID-19. And there is no clarity as to whether that information is going to be accessible by those companies.
But handing over personal information to a government body might be the only way forward. Claire Wenham is Assistant Professor of Global Health Policy with the London School of Economics.
This is where we're going to be able to return to our normal lives. And maybe we have to cede some of our privacy to be able to return back to normal.
Wenham agrees that both the app and the test and trace system are flawed. But she says they're all there is right now.
And we really need this app and to be able to effectively instill a test, trace and isolate mechanism to be able to move forward. I think there's been some confused messaging from the government that seemingly we're out of this now, we're out of the woods, but we're really not.
As for Becky, the contact tracer, she's still waiting for the phone to ring. And she says she started rewatching comedies on Netflix.
I've been watching A Good Place. I've returned back to season 1 and now I'm halfway through season 3.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
A massive oil spill in Siberia has caused Russia to declare a state of emergency in the region. The mining company responsible for the spill says it was partly due to climate change. The permafrost there is melting, and that melting caused a leak in a reservoir holding tens of thousands of tons of diesel fuel. Alexei Kanizhnikov is with the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program. He joins us from Moscow. So we're seeing reports that 20,000 tons of diesel was leaked into the environment. Greenpeace is saying it's one of the world's worst spills ever, comparing it to the Exxon Valdez spill off Alaska in 1989. So how bad is this spill?
Yes, that's true. That's a really huge spill from this broken reservoir. It's spilled into the small river and then go to the bigger river. And responders arrived to the site 2 days after the spill. The responders tried to pump out this fuel from the river surface, and it's not easy task, so it's still a lot of fuel on the river. Unfortunately, that components are very toxic, so we should expect, first of all, the most damage will be done on fish stock in this river.
Well, let's talk about that, because ecosystems in the Arctic, they're in the north and Siberia, I mean, they're very fragile. So what's going to be the impact on these ecosystems?
Yes, that's true. But also true is that exactly this river being heavily polluted by other industrial pollution from this huge mining plant. And fish population was decreasing for many, many years there. Some of of them really rare, like sturgeon, Siberian sturgeon, or salmon. We're afraid that this new portion of pollution will just totally destroy the last fish stock that's still living in this water in very poor condition.
Well, how hard is it to clean up a spill like this? I mean, you're talking diesel, right?
Yeah. We understand that to clean up diesel spill on river is much easier than lake or sea surface because it's not so wide, but the responders, they cover the stream from one bank to another with booms, and actually these booms help them to pump out this fuel.
The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. Climate change has a massive impact on the Arctic. Scientists have warned for decades that thawing of the Arctic permafrost could threaten the stability of industrial infrastructure in the far north, and now we're seeing it. So do industries need to completely rethink how they operate in the Arctic? Is this going to keep continuing?
Yeah, that's true. These new changes, including climate changes, they request even more investment in safety, more project design and construction. So it make it more and more costly. And we can see that already offshore oil development in Russian Arctic, it's much, much more expensive than in other regions. So that's from economic point of view, new level of safety requirements should slow down economic development in such risky regions and fragile regions.
So should the Russian government be doing more to protect the Arctic from future spills, or are they pushing for this oil exploration?
Every disaster causes new requirements. So now we also should expect new level of regulation from Russian authorities for such facilities that deal with oil-based fuels and so on.
Alexei Konieznikov with the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic Program in Russia. He's been speaking with us from Moscow. Thank you very much, Alexei.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Venezuela has been in crisis mode for years. Lack of access to basics like food and medicine has only been made worse by the coronavirus pandemic. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and opposition leader Juan Guaido have been in a tense standoff since 2019 when Guaido declared himself acting president. But the rival governments unexpectedly announced yesterday an agreement to cooperate in raising funds to fight the pandemic. Guillermo Zubiaga is the head of the Venezuela Working Group at the Council of the Americas. What specifics do we have about this agreement, Guillermo?
Well, the specifics that we have is that this is agreement signed by the Maduro government, by the National Assembly, which is led by Juan Guaido, and more importantly, by the Pan-American Health Association.
And where's the money they raise going to go? Doctors and hospitals?
Basically, it is going to go to fight the pandemic. It seems like both sides have seen the rising numbers and the fact that the Maduro government does not have the capacity nor the legitimacy to implement this alone. So, yes, the funds are going to be dedicated to imitate some of the other efforts that you've seen in other places, you know, tracking, testing, isolating patients and addressing those that have already been infected.
What have Maduro and Guaido said about this agreement, and do you think they're going to stick to it?
I think they are going to stick to it just because, you know, I think they're both aware of the magnitude of this pandemic, and this is something that you actually need funding expertise. However, going back to the political, I mean, both are trying to downplay it. They don't want to be seen as, you know, political negotiation. However, I think there is implicit recognition from the Guaido side that Maduro controls the territory and the health system. But more importantly, from the Maduro side, that Guaido is the legitimate head of the National Assembly, something that his Supreme Court recently said he wasn't. And, you know, Maduro says, I am not trusted alone with funds. I don't have the legitimacy. So it is an implicit recognition there that could open the path to other political agreements, hopefully in the future.
So politically, this kind of health agreement on the pandemic suggests to you a stalemate may be broken at some point.
Yes, it's the first time that these two parts have come together. I mean, they're both, again, trying to downplay it. Maduro's communication minister said, we did an agreement with the devil because we can work with the devil. And Guaido people have said, you know, this is only an agreement on health. However, it is the first time that we've seen this kind of communication, something signed. It's also important because having the UN overseeing this agreement will guarantee the safety of medical personnel. the Academy of National Sciences, you know, warned of the increasing numbers of COVID, and immediately the regime suggested that they were going to go after them. So it kind of provides a safe space for this kind of, you know, health alerts to be shared. So I think that is also a very important part of this agreement.
Guillermo, are you hopeful about what this agreement could lead to?
I think this agreement, first of all, I think is going to save thousands of lives, just because you have the expertise of the World Health Organization and you have the ability to talk about it and the ability to raise some international funds that wouldn't be given to Maduro alone if it had not had the seal of approval of the National Assembly. And I am hopeful. I am hopeful. You know, I believe that whenever you have people talking, more can happen from that. It's better than not having anyone talking. Venezuela, as you know, is not only facing the COVID pandemic, it's facing measles, malaria, malnutrition. So there's a lot to be worked on. And, you know, I am hopeful that this will lead eventually at some point to a permanent political solution to Venezuela's current stalemate.
Guillermo Zubillaga, the head of the Venezuela Working Group at the Council of the Americas. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the invitation.
And that's where we leave you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.